Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey folks, Tom Merritt here. This episode of A Word with Tom Merritt covers some pretty dark material. Now, it's, I don't think, something that is horrifying or obscene, but we do talk about September 11th. We talk about Columbine. We obviously talk about COVID-19 and similar events. It's a great conversation, and we keep things objective. We try to keep things respectful. But if you're in a certain headspace, you may not even want to listen to an objective, respectful conversation about these topics. So just in case, we wanted to let you know, if that's you, take time. Come back to this episode if and when you're ready. If you're in a headspace to hear a level-headed discussion that involves those sorts of things, not just those sorts of things, we also hear about Ringo the dog, then please enjoy this episode of A Word with Tom Merritt. Welcome to A Word with Tom Merritt. I'm Tom Merritt. On this show, I get the pleasure and privilege to sit down with some of the smartest, most interesting people in the world and talk about how we think. Not everybody can know everything about everything, so we have to take shortcuts, and those shortcuts are important in understanding the world. So it's good to compare each other's shortcuts and how we approach them. These are kinds of conversations I've been having my whole life with my grandpa Carl in his front room growing up, my grandma Roxy in her front room growing up. I got lots of different ways of looking at the world from them. Great conversations, and it was all leading me to this moment right now. Welcome into the front room, Rob Reed.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here, Tom.
I am a big fan of your work, as you know, your podcasts, your novels. But one thing that runs through those, Rob, including your most recent column in Ars Technica, is that dangers lie ahead that we should be aware of. Do you think that's fair of me to think that?
I think it's fair. I mean, I've written about a lot of different things. I've podcasted about a lot of different things, but I do have a certain obsession, I guess I would say, with existential risk. And many of them have been on my mind at different times in the past, but these days, one existential risk that I've been focused on a lot connects to synthetic biology, and a possibly sub-existential risk connects to artificial intelligence. And I don't mean the runaway paperclip scenario, which is so famous, although I have definitely written about that and have been concerned about it, and I don't rule it out. But maybe something more near term about what happens when neutral AI happens to bad people.
So how did you get into this mode of thinking? Because this goes back, not just this Ars Technica article, but also to the book After On and the podcast After On. What led you from being a very talented tech mogul with some successful startups to worrying about the death of the human race?
Well, believe it or not, it's partly driven from the fact that I'm a bit of a relentless optimist, and I'm also a big lover of ideas. And I get very smitten with new ways of thinking and new concepts that have been made possible by changes, recent changes in science and technology. And I tend to go deep when I get excited about something like that. Existential risk has really kind of became, I'd say, at least in my mind, a big topic maybe about 15 years ago. I'm sure there was stuff out there before, and sometimes it was sort of religious apocalyptic thinking and so forth. But with really the early writing of people like Nick Bostrom, who wrote a lot about the dangers of artificial superintelligence, it just became a really powerful and fascinating idea with some very rigorous thinking behind it that really drew me in, as I've been drawn into a lot of things that have absolutely nothing to do with danger or risk. But also my optimistic side gave me kind of a little bit of a heterodox color for looking at these things, because I think these are dodgeable bullets. And it's my belief that these dangers are profoundly real and things that we need to manage. as well as my innate optimism that, you know what, I think we can manage these things, that really created a bit of a cycle that drew me in. But one of the key aspects about the manageability of these dangers is that we need to be highly, highly attuned to them. We need to know how real and how giant they are and be adequately and appropriately awed by them. So otherwise, I don't think we have a chance against them. So there's kind of a, you know, this kind of mix of fascination with these risks and an innate optimism kind of gives me almost a public service-y compulsion to talk about them and to talk about them, talk about terrible things before they happen so we can, you know, prevent them from happening.
I just based on that description there, it almost feels like the same impulse that you would have if you were to pull someone out of the way of an oncoming car or to yell at them to jump out of the way.
It's akin to that. I mean, I think there are oncoming cars and I think they're avoidable, but I don't think we have, you know, an interminable expanse of time ahead of us to avoid these things. So yeah, it's kind of like saying the British are coming.
Yeah. Look to your right. Stop looking over that way. Cause I think when I think of danger, my default is over history. Lots of people have said things are existential dangers and they weren't as bad as they said. And we are all attuned to danger. We don't want to die. So we figure it out. I do get and I've talked to you about this before in the past, I do get the idea that you think there might be something different about these particular existential dangers. Is that right?
That is true. And I also think that we have this very bizarre tendency to dismiss preparations and or dismiss warnings when people have said, hey, there's a possibility that this bad thing is going to happen. I'm not enough of a student of the whole Y2K thing to have a very deep opinion, a deep technically informed opinion about how bad that risk was and how powerful the mitigating measures were. There is a tendency out there to mock the whole thing in retrospect.
Sure. Yeah.
But the fact is, countless billions of dollars were spent to avert terrible things from happening. The fact that nothing happened could actually be profoundly validating about the concerns that people had and the steps that people had to avert that. Now, again, some people are going to be listening to this and mocking it because it is fashionable to mock it.
Sure.
But I have read some, you know, pretty deep technical retrospectives on it that suggests that, like, you know, really terrifying things, probably not the end of the world, but some really bad stuff might have happened, particularly with weapons systems and so forth. So, you know, sometimes people say, you know, there is a, you know, 20% chance that there'll be a catastrophic, I don't know, earthquake or hurricane, then it doesn't happen. And some folks then have a tendency to laugh about the concern that preceded it. It's a little bit like this. I don't think anybody, upon safely arriving at their destination in a car, would sort of scorn the fact that they, quote unquote, wasted several seconds putting on their seatbelt. We shouldn't. I also don't think we should scorn the TSA, as a lot of people do. You know, how many friends do we have who say, oh, I could hijack a plane tomorrow. They're so dumb. It's so easy. What a waste of time. What a waste of money. The truth is there hasn't been a hijacking of a major airliner since, you know, 9/11. And that is not proof that we're wasting money on the TSA. It's not necessarily proof that they are, you know, an indomitable dam that would prevent any bad thing from happening. But it probably is proof that they're doing quite a bit. And so when we're dismissive about dangers averted, I think that's a normal human psychological reaction. But it's something we need to be really, really careful about. And I think we need to be taking very, very, very significant steps, particularly in synthetic biology safety right now, that a lot of folks, particularly deep within the field, are poo-pooing because they feel that they'll never have a lab accident. They'll never let something go awry. And therefore, why have any kind of protective measures? But particularly when the consequence of failing to take a protective measure that was needed are civilization threatening or quote unquote merely likely to result in the deaths of quote unquote merely 20 million people, mm-hmm. which is what happened with COVID. We need to be really, really careful about that tendency to dismiss the improbable from ever happening because it hasn't happened before, or to dismiss the need to take commonsensical precautions that are not crushingly expensive in order to prevent disaster.
Well, it's a mismatch, isn't it, between our finely attuned sense of danger that will absolutely serve us well on a savanna. We are mm-hmm. the safest creature on the savanna. We know how to spot those dangers and stay away from them, and yet not inordinately spend our energy avoiding them so that we can feed ourselves. But as soon as we're not on a savanna, the dangers change. And some of them we are still good at avoiding and some of them not. And I feel that's very clearly what we're talking about here is there is on the one hand the sort of belief that if I can't see the danger and the danger didn't happen, there wasn't a danger, which if there's no tiger in the grass, then you're fine. And on the other hand, there's the other danger of overreacting. Like every, you know, rustle in the grass can't be a tiger. And if we thought it was, we would never leave and gather food and we would starve, right? It's the old joke of like, you know, why are you playing that horn? It keeps the elephants away. Well, there aren't any elephants. See, it's working, right? So there's that other end of it that you do have to say, well, how do we fine tune it, I guess, is where I'm going. Like, how do we make sure that we are taking the sensible precautions for a danger that's hard to evaluate like that?
Well, I think being aware of our evolutionary psychology, which you just, of course, pointed to, and of its pitfalls is a really, really important first step. Famously, I don't think any of your listeners are unfamiliar with this, something that was very rational for our ancestors to practice during those hundreds of thousands of years, where our instincts were forged by the survivors who had these instincts procreating and the people who didn't have them not procreating. We really like to eat. We like to eat saturated fats. We didn't get too many back then. It was a really good idea to eat them when we had a shot at it. And now we have an obesity problem. So that's a hole I think we're all aware of. A subtler one, which I think is really important, is on the savanna, our ancestors never, ever encountered exponential processes. That is not something that happens. Well, it does happen in nature. It can happen in a pandemic. It can happen, you know, with a microbe, you know, blowing up in terms of its population. But it's not something that happened visibly. And it was not something that presented a visible threat to our ancestors. And so it's not something that we're wired to think in terms of. And that's why our instincts really fail us when we're confronting an existential process. And we simply cannot intuitively grasp or fear where it's heading. So one interesting and important example is obviously Moore's Law. If we grew up with a very strong intuition for how exponential processes unfold, we wouldn't have been shocked as we were routinely year after year after year by what computing became capable of. Most recent example, oh my God, generative AI.
Yeah.
You know, we have systems that for all intents and purposes are slaughtering the Turing test, which was a milestone that the computing industry chased for 70 years. And all of a sudden, it's not just passed, it's crushed. We had image classification systems that for decades could not tell a dog from a cat. And then famously, maybe a decade ago, they were able to microscopically, not exactly, that's a euphemism, determine every subbreed known to man or woman. And we're certainly seeing it with image generation right now. In the realm of synthetic biology, I think our intuitions fail us because we look at what would be beyond the powers of the very, very, very top people in the field. And I'm going to go back to about, let's say, 2006 or so. In 2006 or so, almost nobody would have been able to synthesize a virus from whole cloth just by knowing the base pairs in the genome. And in that environment, The National Institutes of Health made a very, very, very foolish decision, which was to put the smallpox genome on the internet. And while they were at it, to put the, you know, the Spanish influenza genome on the internet, roughly that time. I'm not going to have the year right. Mm. Ray Kurzweil, who is the dean of exponential thinking, made the very, acute and appropriate warning. He signed an open letter signed by many others saying, please do not do this, because synthetic biology is an exponential technology, just like computing, which means the implausibility of anybody being able to synthesize one of these things from whole cloth today has no bearing on what people will be able to do 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now. And indeed, at this point, those genomes, which are known to anybody, could be synthesized by many, many tens of thousands of people if they had something nasty in mind. Now, tens of thousands of people is a very frighteningly high number when you're talking about a capability that could have devastating ramifications for a towering number of people. And the reason I say that is, like, look back at the Cold War. We were appropriately very, very concerned about not tens of thousands of people, but roughly two people at any given moment hitting the flashing red button. You know, Khrushchev yeah. and Kennedy, you know, Brezhnev and Reagan, I guess. Nixon, Reagan also came, Reagan, yeah. joined up with Gorbachev as well. But, like, that dyad of two people was scary enough. And we collectively as a society spent trillions of dollars, literally, on regional wars, diplomacy, detection systems to dissuade those two people from doing something that they were highly disinclined to do anyway. When you have tens of thousands of people who can unleash something terrifying, it's a very different thing. Now, luckily, we probably, for a long, long set of reasons, humans are not as vulnerable as one might think, at least to the Spanish flu. The fact that the smallpox genome is up there, which is a much more complicated construct, is wildly problematic. But we're taking steps that go far, far, far beyond that when scientists engage in something called gain of function research, which is, to strip it down and really make it simple, is taking a deadly pathogen and making it much more deadly in a laboratory setting in order to study what it might be like if this thing that nature has never produced and is unlikely to ever produce got out. Well, it's not really going to happen unless we make it. And if we make those kinds of things and we publish those genomes online and time passes as it does, 10, 15 years from now, it's not just going to be tens of thousands of people who could make something devastating. It's going to be hundreds of thousands and millions. And then basically any smart undergrad in a bio class. That kind of proliferation is driven by the exponential advance of synthetic biology, the radical steady dropping in the cost of synthesizing a base pair of nucleic acid, which has actually plateaued a little bit in the last 5 or 6 years. That's a rabbit hole we don't have to go down. But it's going to unplateau soon, and it's going to continue down its exponential curve. And our intuitions fail us when we try to foresee what can happen based on what's possible today when an exponential technology is in play. And the same thing can certainly be said for computing and potentially for artificial intelligence.
I mean, but is there any avoiding that? Even if you don't publish it, it's known somewhere. Someone can get a hold of it. Someone can reverse engineer it. You might be kicking the can down a road a little ways, but how much prevention is that?
Well, let's go back to hijacking, actually. In the late 1960s, actually, this is a fun stat, and because I'm asking the leading question, you're probably going to make a pretty big guess, but how many hijackings do you think we had on average per year in the late 60s, early 70s in the United States, domestic only?
I don't know, but I do remember hearing about them. The jokes were always like, ah, yes, the Cuban terrorists hijacked a plane. So if I had to guess, I'd say 2 or 3?
50.
50. Wow. Yeah.
50 hijackings a year at their peak in the late 60s, up from substantially zero for the first few decades of aviation. Then somebody did it, and the meme got out there. And I think the somebody did it was either you know, 1959, early 60s.
So it was 50 and attempted and then...
No, 50 successful hijackings a year by the late 60s.
Well, what was the somebody did it then?
Somebody did it. Well, nobody thought of it. It's like a meme. I mean, how many school shootings were there per year before Columbine? They were always possible, but suddenly somebody did it. And then that kind of broke a taboo, or suddenly everybody realized it was possible. And by the late 1960s, there were about 50 hijackings per year successful.
Oh, there were none until somebody did it.
There were none until somebody did it. Somebody did it in the, you know,
and then,
early
and then
60s.
Everybody's like, oh, it's possible. Let me do it too. Yeah, yeah.
Not only was it possible, you could do it on a whim. There was no airport security whatsoever, like literally none. And ironically, it was the airlines who were fighting airport security because they were afraid it would send a bad message. Well, I'll tell you what sends a bad message. Yeah. A weekly hijacking.
Sure.
And you're right. The Cuba thing, it was a lot of hippie hijackers, a lot of radicals. Many of them hijacked the plane to Cuba. Most of them didn't kill anybody, but some of them did. It got so bad that Castro literally set up a dormitory in Havana for wayward American hijackers. Now, finally, the airline industry and the FAA decide we're going to put, like, you know, magnetic detectors in the airports, drop to 0 to 1 almost immediately. Then we had 9/11 and we hardened cockpit doors and we professionalized airport security and we have substantially 0 now. Does that mean hijackings are impossible? Absolutely not. What it does mean is that we've put in a lot of speed bumps that at this point, I think it would take an organization that is more motivated and more resourced than Al-Qaeda to successfully hijack an American plane domestically. Can such an entity exist? Of course it can. But few enough do, because we've taken some pretty inexpensive, commonsensical measures, inexpensive compared to the trillions that we spent on wars and other types of anti-terrorist activity post 9/11, very inexpensive, to make it so hard that only a limited number of people can do it. And when it's a very limited number of people, you can keep a better eye on them. It's a finite pool. Now intelligence can take over. In the realm of synthetic biology, the first thing we need to do is stop making ourselves wildly vulnerable by creating extravagantly dangerous superpathogens that, in one case that I'm aware of, could literally kill 50% of the people it infects, that are being created for absolutely no good reason. And they're being put in these very leaky vessels called laboratories. And I say leaky because
every— Is it no good reason, though? Like, I the only reason I want to challenge you on that is like the person who made it probably can come up with a very good reason why they made it.
Of course. Yeah. Well, they want to be on the cover of Nature. They want to be on the cover of Science. They want to advance their career.
But do they want to be on the cover for making the thing that can kill 50% of the people? Or are they gambling like, but if I make this, I'll be able to come up with an advance based on it?
Well, so that is the theory, what you just said.
Yeah, okay.
We need to think about the logic of that.
Sure, sure.
When COVID came along, this is a little known fact. Everybody knows it took about 400 days to get the first vaccines. What few people know is that that was a two-step process. It was the development of the successful vaccine and its approval, then distribution. So three-step process.
Yeah. Not to mention a head start of years of basic research that, you know, set it up, but sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And I'll get to that in a second. Yeah, yeah. But again, sort of a leading question. Do you know how long step one, create the effective vaccine? Do you know how long that took?
Yeah. After the last question, I'm going to say a day, but I'm sure.
You're close. 48 hours.
Yeah. Okay.
So that was the dawning days of mRNA technology. It took 48 hours to get the winning vaccine. So let's think about this, because it is often when people engage in work like this and work connected to this, there's things that go beyond gain of function, like virus hunting and finding viruses in isolated bat caves where they would never otherwise intersect with human society. When you either create or find and bring into a leaky vessel, and I say leaky vessel because all categories of laboratory leak, all the way up to biosafety level 4, which is the highest that we've got, there are countless examples at every BSL level of terrible things getting out. So just take that and leave that aside for a second. So let's say somebody makes the argument, and it has been made, and it's being made again, that, you know what, why don't we go into all these remote bat caves, find these viruses that would probably never, ever, ever intersect with human society, but take them out of the cave, put it in a BSL-2 lab with a terrible safety record in a very dense urban area, because by poking and prodding at it, why, maybe we'll be able to come up with a vaccine. Okay, fine. You've saved 36 hours. You've taken this profound risk that didn't otherwise need to be taken. You've accelerated the path to a vaccine, in theory, by 36 hours. But you still have this extraordinarily important approval, regulation, and scaling issue to go through. So you may have carved 1% off of the path to the vaccine, and in exchange of that, you have brought a tremendous risk into the midst of human society. And I don't want to go deep into the lab leak debate, but it is safe to say that essentially no credible virologist or epidemiologist at this point puts the odds of a lab leak at zero. Mm-hmm. I've dug pretty deep into this, and the folks that I believe know the most about this, and by the way, have nothing to gain from it. There is no professional advancement or money to be made by proving it was a lab leak. There might be political point scoring in some areas, but that's not the way that virologists and epidemiologists think. The folks I know have dealt in the deepest range anywhere from 50 to 90% likelihood. And more toward the top. It's very, very plausible it came from there. Even if the risk of that is 10% on an expected value basis of the, you know, given the total number of casualties that would ensue, something really ghastly came out, why would you incur that tremendous risk in order to shave 1%-ish off the, you know, the path to a vaccine coming out? And it's a case of regulatory capture. There is a community of scientists who practice this, who are perfectly genuinely persuaded that they're doing important good work. They're not mustache twirling Bond villains, but they kind of self-regulate because it's people from this community that, you know, approve journal articles for one another or mm-hmm. sit on each other's institutional review boards or, you know, take roles of the government where they decide to fund this kind of thing for their former colleagues at the institutions where they used to practice it. It's a crazy, crazy situation. And there are a number of, like, you know, equivalents to hardening the cockpit door. First of all, A, just don't do this. But then B, there's things that we can put into our synthetic biology architecture that would make it very, very hard for people to synthesize truly dangerous sequences of DNA, RNA. And we could go into that. But these are things that are already being practiced to a certain degree on a voluntary basis by the industry that could be beefed up and made universal. And that's where you start building the immune system to prevent what, like you just said, might seem unpreventable. That's where the optimist in me kicks in, mm-hmm. which says, yeah, we cannot make it impossible, but we can make it as hard as hijacking a plane. And when you make it as hard as hijacking a plane and radically cut down on the proliferation, the nightmare scenario really, let's say 15, maybe 20 years from now, is that somebody like a Columbine kid or a Vegas shooter can do this at will. You know, far too many people, mm-hmm. you know, when the pool gets big enough, at some point, inevitably, you're going to have somebody very, very disturbed in that pool who will do something catastrophic. We need to keep that pool very tiny.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think about this a lot in the sense of there are things that we have made into social norms. No one needs to be standing at a four-way traffic light and enforce it, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's an opportunity. It's a lower risk opportunity, but it's an opportunity for someone to do bad. Someone can run that red light at any time, and occasionally they do, but it is commonly accepted that they are always in the wrong if they have. And so we've built up a social norm. There's the social norm of not going into someone else's building that isn't quite as strong. If that door is open, well, it was open. Maybe I should wander in. If the door is closed, fewer people are going to try, but still some people are like, let me see if that door is open. If the door is locked, you can still get in. It is not impossible to, in fact, it's not even that hard to learn how to pick a lock. But locks are very effective because now you've, to your point, you've raised the trouble of getting into that door to be like, well, I'm not going to do it on a whim. It would take a lot of preparation. Is it really worth it? Am I going to get anything by going into that? And I feel like these are both metaphors that apply to what you're talking about, which is it's not that we'll stop people from being able to know what the smallpox virus is, but locking the door still helps dissuade people.
Yeah, exactly. And hardening cockpit doors and simple metal detectors, took the number of hijackings down almost by 100% without making them impossible.
But with you the TSA thing, don't you think that there is maybe a little some of it is inefficient? Some of it is stopping,
for sure.
is causing people to do things that and causing costs that aren't preventing things? Like, how do you stop it from going too far the other way?
Yeah, no, without question. And that's why we don't have cops at every intersection. I think at some point there's a trade-off between the additional cost that you incur and the catastrophe that you're averting. We could put a cop at every intersection. We would probably prevent a few hundred deaths a year. I don't know how many people are killed by running red lights, but there is ultimately a social cost because that outcome is not utterly catastrophic. It is horrific, and it's devastating for the people involved when there is a death at a red light. But when you compare the total number of deaths to the total number of cops we'd have to hire, it doesn't make sense. Yeah, with TSA, with anything the government does, and frankly, almost anything that business does, could be made more efficient. But if we look at it, I'm looking at it more in a binary way. Mm-hmm. Yes, of course, I'd love to see the TSA be more efficient without any question, and everything else that's done. The DMV as well, when you get right down to it. If you look at it from a binary standpoint and you say, do we have the suite of protections that we have right now, or do we not have them? Really the cost of 9/11, beyond the number of people who died that day, which was actually less than the number of people who were dying daily of COVID for months and months and months in a stretch. But it really was, kind of changing geopolitics in such a profound way. And, rational people can debate whether things like invading Iraq had anything to do with terrorism. But nonetheless, that was, its roots traced to a mentality that ensued post 9/11. So the costs of 9/11, I don't think it's irrational to say really were trillions of dollars. Mm. And whatever our budget is for, TSA and the other things it's a speck compared to that. So I'm sure glad that they're there, even though they could obviously be improved. And when I think about Synbio, it's a similar set of precautionary steps that won't make things impossible, but would make bad things radically less plausible or probable, mm-hmm. and probably reduce the total number of incidents immensely. And we're unfortunately not really doing any of them.
Yeah. It's who gets to decide the risk reward line, right? What's the equivalent of hardening the cockpit doors for synthetic bio? And what's the equivalent of making everyone, put 3 ounces of Colgate in a plastic bag, and maybe it has less effect. I actually don't know if that's the worst example or not, but you get my idea, which is there are things that are probably having little effect that maybe we could get rid of and are a little inconvenience. And there are things like hardening the cockpit door, which I think, yes, very clearly have a good effect. And so I'm not trying to say what's the line. I'm trying to say, how do you determine that line? Who gets to determine that line, I think, is the key, right?
I think it's ultimately a very intractably complex dance between society, legislators, regulators, lobbyists, and the various people who end up, getting their hands on something. So in the case of terrorism, there was more or less universal outrage on the part of American society and the electorate that something had to be done. And with that mandate, the president and Congress got to work, and there was a broadly shared sense that a lot of money can and should be spent against this. And the invasion of Afghanistan was not terribly controversial in the United States when it happened, although Iraq certainly was. And obviously, well, we could go on and on and on about that.
Sure.
But the first thing that has to happen is that either there is a strong jolt of concern from society that gets some balls in motion, or sometimes, you know, lobbyists get involved or people, members of civil society get involved, and they are effective enough in warning legislators and regulators that, hey, we need to do something. In the case of COVID, there was a $60 billion pandemic prevention bill that looked like it was likely to pass through Congress, but we had this very bizarre situation that COVID had become a partisan issue, and concern about pandemics had become a partisan issue, and a kind of a complicated one. It wasn't, you know, some simplistic thing of Republicans didn't want to wear masks and thought it was silly to worry, and Democrats were the opposite. There was a little bit of a mix. I would say at this point, the Republicans are far more concerned about things like lab safety. And it's a weird thing. It doesn't cut on clean partisan lines, but basically there wasn't enough money to get that through. One thing that could be like hardening the cockpit doors, there's already a voluntary system where about 80% of the producers of DNA in the United States and in the West in general are a member of an organization which for many years has been maintaining a database of DNA sequences of concern. And when a lab or a company orders a strand of DNA, and that is generally, if it's a long construct, it almost invariably comes out of a central service bureau, because the people who use long constructs of DNA are generally not capable of making them, because that's not their thing. They're scientists and researchers and pharma companies and biotech startups that want to do things with specific, you know, lengths of, you know, gene length or virus length or other lengths of DNA. They want to do things with it. They have very clear ideas of what they want to do in the lab, but they don't want to make it and develop the skills to make it, you know, any more than, a generative AI startup would want to make its own computers, right? Mm-hmm. So they come from service bureaus, and most of them adhere to a set of practices that flag DNA sequences of concern and start a review process. That's mostly in the United States and the West. It is voluntary. It's kind of leaky. We could beef that up a great deal by saying, I mean, look, if 20% of providers don't do that, then obviously a bad guy can get around it without even a second's thought by going to one of those. It should be hardened up. It should be all providers of DNA and RNA constructs. It should be a reasonably well-funded process to make sure that the database is incredibly robust. And it should be an international agreement like the Montreal Protocol or the nuclear test ban. Are those things easy to implement? No, particularly the international bit. Is it feasible? Yes. Would it be expensive? Barely. I mean, this is not an expensive step to take. So that's an example of the kinds of speed bumps that we could start presenting. And if you do that, then all of a sudden, it becomes really, really, really hard to create a virus length piece of DNA that you could then boot up into a scaffolding to actually make a virus. Not impossible for the most brilliant people in the field, but pretty damn hard and a lot more detectable. And suddenly you don't have to worry about tens of thousands and eventually millions of people doing something bad without any guardrails. You're now worrying about a pretty tiny population of people. And that reduction of proliferation alone is a very big deal, because particularly the very, very talented people in the middle of that circle are less likely to look psychologically like a teenager with a machine gun, or, you know, a societal dropout with a machine gun, who are the people who perpetrate, you know, not in all cases, but in many cases, mass shootings.
So that sounds reasonable for that problem. But what I keep running into is every time we do have a new problem, it's so hard to come up with the appropriate, reasonable response. And there's people like yourself who have a good shot of being able to explain a potential appropriate, reasonable response for any given problem. But then we have people in positions of implementation with different motivations. In the sense of TSA security at the checkpoint, it may be people who are like, I'm not going to let anything through that I could get blamed at, so I'm going to overdo it. That way I won't get in trouble. And then you have some
TSA PTSD, yeah. Tom.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm just thinking of like the long security lines that show up two hours ahead. The people who are in charge of TSA are like, yeah, of course, if you're inconvenienced, fine, but I'm not going to get blamed. They're not motivated to make it more efficient, right? On the other hand, then you have something like the COVID response where everybody wants to solve it. But if I can find a little wiggle room to motivate my base, you know, then right. I'm going to go for that. And that's what we saw this last time. So all this is leading to me is not to bash on the TSA. I think the TSA does a really good job.
No, they're a good example because it's vivid to all of us. Yeah, it's actually an excellent example.
It's not even the TSA. It's the policies behind it that I sometimes question at the gate. But without going down that rabbit hole, I look at the open source community as an inspiration for, could we create an independent, trusted, and it would have to be trusted for it to work, organization that is in charge of assessing dangers and weighing in on things like that. Obviously, with open source communities, it's a tighter community. There's less on the line. It's easier to make that stuff done. So maybe it doesn't translate. But I do feel like there are too many people with counter motivations to the optimal result. And that's why we keep running into these difficulties in getting the optimal result. So I wonder, is there a way to create an ombudsman for this, for an ombudsman for danger, if you will?
I like the idea. I just don't know how it would work. You know,
How do you get it going? How do you get it trusted? It would get very politicized.
Yeah. It would get,
right.
I mean, drunk on power. It would. Yeah. No, I mean, this is why I just think you need, you know, informed optimists who are attuned to and aware of certain issues and are willing to spend thousands of hours of their lives, which is what I've done in the case of Synbio. I've done a lot of stuff on that. We can rabbit hole into that or not. And by the way, I'm a very pro Synbio person. I invest in synthetic biology as a VC.
Well, it makes sense for you to want to stop synthetic bio from ruining everything so that you can get the good out of it. That makes sense.
Right. No, there's tremendous good to be had to be had from this. And so ham-fisted regulation is certainly not the answer. Trying to ban it is not the answer because that basically says, well, we're going to let China do this and not do it ourselves, or we're going to let the bad guys run amok and we're not going to learn how to prevent them. But I just think in a diversity of fields, you need informed optimists who are really, really willing to work very hard on it and evangelize their perspective and come up with solutions that may not be obvious and try to talk to, you know, commonsensical regulators, B corporations, all the other actors, and talk them into a mindset where catastrophic risks aren't taken. The good thing is, we're all pretty much unified in not wanting civilization to end tomorrow.
Yeah. There's a very small percentage that want civilization to end tomorrow.
But the interesting thing is that they are out there.
Yeah.
And they never got their hands on nuclear bombs because it was such a hard technology to proliferate. And so when we have an exponential technology that might empower, you know, an extreme anti-natalist, extreme misanthrope, somebody who's extreme in their perspective on animal welfare or environment, who's decided that humanity is a blight on the surface of the earth. If the worst thing they can do is grab an automatic machine, or I guess not technically machine gun, automatic rifle and kill a bunch of random people, that is really bad. But it's not ultimately catastrophically dangerous. It's when we get exponential technologies that could enable very powerful things that our intuitions fail us to realize are possible, that's when we're in some risk. But by the way, there's lots of things in life that I'm happy about as well.
Yeah, that the word was danger. So, you know,
this is danger. We can keep going in danger. I'm not opposed to that.
No, we can go wherever we want to, but I feel like this is productive. I guess the one area that we haven't touched on as much as maybe some listeners are expecting us to is generative AI.
Yeah.
is machine learning and everything. I think synthetic bio is a very significant danger, and I'm glad we spent as much time talking about it as we have. Do you think that the hockey stick is coming for? I try not to use AI because I like to be specific, but I think in this case, you know, to lump in large language models and multimodal and everything together in AI, do you think is appropriate? Do you think we're headed towards something that could get scary and get out of hand?
I don't know about existentially dangerous. I'm not so worried about that in this case. But when I did think about AI, and I would worry about the Nick Bostrom, James Barrett type of failure modes where superintelligence arises, blasts past our level of intelligence so rapidly that we don't even realize it. And it's as intelligent in relation to us as we are in bacteria, as we are to bacteria. And it develops goals that are, you know, sublime and important goals to it that are inconsistent with our survival. That's the Terminator scenario. And that's an important scenario to think about. That's what I used to think about when I thought about this. I think there's a much nearer term danger, and the title of my Ars Technica piece from last week rounds to, I may not say this verbatim, but let's not worry about the AI breaking out of its box, but us breaking into its box, us breaking in. And so the example is we suddenly have these profoundly powerful and amazing and exhilarating to me. I am so fascinated and delighted by so much of what's happening in generative AI. But these tools kind of came out of, you know, following the exponential path from society's perspective. They kind of started coming out of nowhere this past summer. And, you know, with all the image generation tools, which are getting better and better with incredible rapidity, and then profoundly, I mean, I think people will look back in November and the release of ChatGPT as being, you know, a pivotal moment in the history of people and their relationship.
Which is hilarious because I've talked to more than one person at OpenAI who are like, yeah, it was just another release until suddenly it wasn't, right?
It was just a different user interface. And interacting with GPT-3, just the LLM, required API access and or a deep awareness that it was out there that not very many people have. It hit a moment. And yeah, I know they were surprised by how big it took off. And I think that they rushed it out because they thought things were coming from Google and Facebook that ultimately were not. They may regret the timing, I'm not sure, but it's out there. What I worry about in this realm isn't the AI taking over. It's the kinds of people who are behind things like phishing attacks, crypto scams, all kinds of spam, all that kind of fraud, or people who deliberately try to rip a society apart by interfering in elections or sowing dissension. We've seen what these people can do already. That type of actor armed with really powerful generative AI tools can be capable of so much more than before. And that's what worries me more than anything. There's a very sophisticated form of phishing attack that is performed on, you know, relatively wealthy people with a lot of resources, and it's very, very bespoke. There was an article, I think it might have been in the journal. It was a couple of months ago. I had to dig it up about a wave of attacks that's being perpetrated on Chinese Americans who were born in China. So they have roots there. They're from a village. They're culturally, fluent with pop music and everything that goes on there. And there have been these gangs that have been attacking them in a very patient way, reaching out to somebody who, by tracking them on social media and other mechanisms, realize a little bit isolated, a little bit lonely, and they'll meet them through something that, not like an email saying I'm a Nigerian prince, but they'll bump into them in a forum or a Reddit or some other forum and establish a relationship with them. And the case that I saw put out in detail was, in one case, the attacker said, oh, there's this new crypto thing you might be interested in. The person put in a small amount of money, started apparently making money. Like, whoa, I'm up, 10%, 30%, 100%. I made 25 grand, and gradually get lured into a relationship of trust, which ends with their bank account being completely cleared out.
Sure.
That's an expensive form of attack to make. I just had dinner with somebody two nights ago who's a good friend of his father had an attack where somebody had basically made a pretty impressive video of his kid. You know, oh my God, you know, his kid was traveling in Europe. And he's like, oh my God, something bad happened. I'm like, got in trouble in Romania. Could you please wire me $10,000? That's an expensive thing to do. When that is as cheap as sending out spam, I think we have problems. My guess is that most of your listeners are not QAnon followers and regard it with suspicion and worry. Maybe some are. I, you know, not to offend anybody, but it's amazing how much QAnon hijacked the attention of many tens of millions of people and created extravagant distrust in them toward other members of American society. Imagine a QAnon coming along. There's a site called the.com and another one called Durable that'll let you build a website, a really good website, in a matter of seconds, literally under a minute. Imagine if there's suddenly thousands and thousands of self-reinforcing websites out there that promote a really scary, sketchy ideology with unbelievable evident credibility, you know, because they're replete with articles that allegedly ran for 7 minutes in the New York Times or USA Today or other well-known outlets and then were censored, or they are interviews of an enemy politician making enormously dangerous confessions to a famous news anchor. And then that was censored. Like, imagine QAnon with an unbelievable web of self-reinforcing evidence and a drumbeat of daily news written very articulately. In, you know, that's a risk. With basically Sydney, the doppelganger of Bing Chat, kind of crushing the Turing test. Let's face it. It was clear that Sydney was an AI because they were, the long conversations that were had with Sydney, were had by tech journalists talking about her AI-ness. But if they were talking about something else, this seems an awful lot like a person. A flood of bots that are out there that we quote unquote meet online and establish relationships with who purport to be sentient people, that there's a very big backstory establishing their human credentials with their Facebook and their Insta and all this other stuff with malevolent intent. I mean, I think the number of evident humans online that can speak fluently and have an interesting history and can engage a person in Turing test passing conversations are at some point could really actually outnumber our own population. And it's that kind of synthetic media, ulterior motives, immaculately hidden, all in the guise of things that visibly to us online look as credible and as well-designed and well-attested as anything else online. That's what worries me now. I think that it's not AI taking over the world. It's not AI, quote unquote, being bad, but it's malevolent actors leveraging extraordinarily powerful tools to subvert our interests. So that's what worries me today more than the paperclip scenario.
Yeah. Well, especially because we are going to get tested on our ability to see the wires. You know, and I usually use TV as an example. 720p HD looked like you were looking through a window until you got used to it. And then you're like, nah, it's really good. But then 4K really looked like you were looking through a window until you got used to it. I think the idea of the temperature setting on large language models is a great example of the kind of thing that does start to give me a little bit of the chills of like, oh, that is entirely there to fool us into not seeing the wires. And a very brief explanation for people. If you have a large language model, always pick the most likely next word. It ends up kind of sounding dry and you can sort of tell. You can't necessarily tell it's an AI, but you can sort of see the pattern of like, oh, okay, now I'm used to that's what an AI sounds like. And yeah, maybe some people still sound like that, but you can recognize it. The temperature setting says, well, don't always pick the most likely next word. Sometimes pick the second or the third or the fourth. And the temperature is like, how often do you do that? How far down the list? And when you do that, you start to get creativity. That's a very simplistic explanation of it, but that kind of thing is only going to get, as you keep saying, exponentially better to the point where it's going to be very difficult to tell, oh, that's not a person. Not to mention synthesizing voices is getting better so that the fact that this has never been me on this entire podcast could be possible, right, in the future. So it's all of that together. Yeah, I think that's worth sitting up and taking notice of. I'm 100% with you there too.
And it's not AI with volition. It's the bad actors that we have all encountered, you know, with phishing attacks, with spam, with fake news, with election subversion. We're familiar with all of these things. We've encountered them all. We have our defenses up against them. It's that getting really, really magnified. Yeah. But again, I just want to go back to saying I am unbelievably excited about what's happening in generative AI. I think there's unbelievably gorgeous, amazing, empowering, loneliness fighting, all kinds of things that are already starting to happen and will continue to happen. And so I do think that this is going to be a profound net positive, but I also think it's going to be as disruptive to society and the economy, hopefully in a positive way, but as disruptive as the internet itself as it matures.
Yeah. And all disruptions are unequally applied. And the trick is figuring out where you think they're going to be the most disruptive, and then how do you help deal with that? But I don't think you stop them because sometimes I think a lot of the times the solution to the disruption is in the disruption itself.
Yeah, it lies within the tool set that's being developed. Yeah.
Well, Rob, this is fantastic. I always love talking to you. Thank you for taking the time today to do this. I always like to finish these episodes with a little word game. Are you in? Yeah. Very simple.
I am in.
Yeah. It's just called This or That. I'll give you two options and you pick one and tell me why.
I'm in.
We'll start with an easy one. They're all easy, actually. But this one should be super easy. California or New York?
Well, that actually isn't easy because we've lived in both and I love them both. But I've voted with my feet. We were in New York City for quite a few years and we're back here and we're going to stay here. I prefer California really because it's the highest density of the people that I love the most are here. And, you know, the normal trade-offs of weather versus density and exciting and so forth. It's kind of a jump ball for me, but you know, it's hard to make new old friends and most of my old friends are here and I love it here because there's obviously so many advantages to being here anyway.
Isn't that always the way? I how many times have you heard somebody say like, you know, my job's okay, but I really love the people I work with, right? That's the kind of thing you're talking about. It always makes a difference.
Yeah. That's the most important thing.
All right. MP3 or AAC?
AAC.
Why?
I just think it sounds better.
Just sounds better. Yeah.
Yeah. Simple as that.
And honestly, they're almost interchangeable. I bet a lot of people are using one or the other and don't even know which one they're using.
Probably. That's just my sort of leaning. Coke, Pepsi. You know, I probably couldn't tell the difference. You're right.
Well, that gives me an idea. I want to do an MP3 AAC Coke Pepsi test one of these days. That's a good idea.
That would be interesting. Do it.
Fast or slow zombies?
Slow zombies. I'd rather be able to avoid them.
You want to get away.
I want to get away. Yeah, I want to get away. So definitely prefer slow.
Video games or board games?
Board games. Yeah, I like interacting face-to-face with people. I like being in the same physical space with people. I like, you know, obviously, and I'm talking about player to player, but I like being with people. And obviously oftentimes many, many times you're playing a video game on your own. I like board games.
Do you think it's an extrovert introvert thing or does it not map that neatly?
If it does map, I guess board games would be a little more extroverted, but I have a lot of introverted friends who love them.
Yeah. And there's a lot of extroverts who love playing online games.
For sure.
You're interacting with people. So, yeah. Savory or dessert crepes?
Savory.
Oh.
Yeah. I do like sweet, but my weakness is yummy, savory stuff. I don't dislike sweets, but I'm 10x more likely to grab the savory thing.
This is a consistent one across my interviews. And when I put it in there, I'm like, well, everybody's going to pick dessert. 100% the opposite.
I would take
two people would pick dessert.
I would take Fritos over Oreos. I like Oreos a great deal, but I like that savory,
salty.
You
know, when you put it that way, I mean, Fritos are nature's perfect trinity of ingredients, corn oil
they
and
really
salt.
Are.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Dogs or cats?
Love them both, but I'm a dog person.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to choose.
Ringo the dog, our latest little rescue boy, is just the light of my life.
Ringo. How is Ringo?
Yeah.
How old is Ringo?
Ringo is... Ringo's about 2.
Okay.
We don't know exactly because he came from a shelter.
Sure.
And he is so full of joy and charisma and excitement. And he loves all people and he loves all dogs. And his neurological setting is just happy. He's happy by default. If I could spend an hour a week in Ringo's neurological state, I'd want to live forever.
I mean, generative AI can get us there.
There we go.
A little synth bio, combine them both.
Indeed.
We could all be Ringos someday. That's fantastic. What do you know what kind of dog he even is? Or is
we did the genetic test. I mean, he looks like a dachshund meets a Jack Russell Terrier, but amazingly, he's 50% miniature pincher, minpin, which he doesn't really particularly look like to me, but that's what the genetic folks said.
All right.
So a purebred got it on with an absolute mutt because he's half minpin and, you know, a 40th, 20 other things.
That's my dog Sawyer. So you've met Sawyer the dog. He's still kicking. He's half purebred border collie and half everything else you can think of.
Just, yeah, that's Ringo.
Write it down. AI or robots?
AI.
You like the AI. Brains, not the brawn.
Well, I think I'm fascinated by both. And, you know, there are many people, obviously, who have worked in both fields. And a lot of the earliest pioneers of AI were also, like Rodney Brooks, working in robotics, interestingly. But, I just think that there is more – AI is more on the Moore's Law curve of things changing so rapidly because you don't have – you know, the challenges of, you know, the physicality of making atoms dexterous.
Yeah.
It could just rocket along at the speed of Moore's Law. And that speed of innovation and change really fascinates me.
You know, now that you say that, some of the biggest advances in robotics I've read about recently involve using simulations to get rid of that physical barrier.
For sure.
Yeah.
And they will accelerate as well. But AI.
Hot or cold?
Cold. And this is a narrow application. I can handle a cold day much better than a hot day. I spent 3 summers and also an entire year connecting 2 of those summers in Cairo. So I can handle hot. But I'm one of those people that when everybody is shivering at an outdoor restaurant, I'm more or less fine. So I think I've got a higher than average tolerance for cold. And so I'd rather have, a colder than average day than a hotter than average day.
I wish I was like that at restaurants like that. I am always, I can't handle cold. That's why I'm living in one of the hottest places I could find.
It was a hidden superpower for most of my life, but for a couple of years, it's like, damn, this is a good trick I got up my sleeve.
Yeah. Not bad at all. Well, Rob, thank you again. If folks want to read your works, follow what you do, where should they go?
I am about to start podcasting again. I've been on a year's hiatus. And actually, my last podcast was about a particularly fascinating synbio risk that we have averted. But the podcast is called After On, which was the title of an old novel of mine. So the After On podcast with Rob Reed, first episode in a year coming up in just a few days. And it will be about generative AI. And it's generally, as you know, interview based, with generally skewing toward really brilliant scientists and tech folks.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
As guests. So that's the main thing. I'm on Twitter I think I'm Rob_Reed. I should know that. Got about 10,000 Twitter followers. I'm not very active there. I'd say the best place to look for me is the podcast. And at some point in the next 2 or 3 days, I am finally starting a Substack. Don't know the exact address, but it'll be Rob Reed Substack.
Yeah. And it's R-E-I-D, right?
R-E-I-D, yes. Yeah, thank Rob, you for pointing Rob that out. Reed. That is an important thing, yeah.
Excellent. Thank you again, Rob. Thank you so much. This was super fun.
And thank you, Tom.
And thanks to our producers, Jen Cutter and Anthony Lemos. Thank you for listening to this show and telling your friends about it. You can get an ad-free version of this show with Acast Plus. Click on Access Exclusive Content at awordpodcast.com. We'll have a word with you next time.